Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle, Washington. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, amateur and professional sports bring out the fan, and sometimes the fanatic, in people worldwide. Athletes are modern-day gladiators. So it shouldn't surprise us when Professor Eric Davis says, quote, "Sports is essentially a reflection of the best of who we are and the worst of who we are," unquote. At its best, sports raises us up and breaks down barriers. At its worst, it can trigger violence and treat athletes as commodities to be used up and discarded. In this episode of Speakers Forum, how do we go about educating, training, and employing athletes in the U.S., and how does race factor into that equation? Sports Illustrated recently estimated that 80% of retired NFL players go broke within 3 years of retiring. Does the world of sports exploit or empower minority athletes? Humanities Washington presented this Think and Drink event on April 20th, 2015 at the Royal Room in Columbia City. Journalist Tanya Mosley moderated this discussion with Bellevue College sociology professor Eric Davis and former University of Washington basketball star Donald Watts. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Please be advised, the following program contains language of an adult nature.
I'm the program director for Humanities Washington. For those of you who don't know who we are, we're a private nonprofit organization dedicated to sparking conversation and critical thinking using story as a catalyst. This program, Think and Drink, is just one of many programs that we have. We serve the entire state. So this is the first program of the 2015 season. So we're really happy to kind of kick things off with some incredible people here. So we encourage you to talk and ask questions. We want this to be a conversation. But just really quickly, if you do want to ask a question, if you can use that microphone in the back, that would be great because we are recording this for KUOW. With that, I'm going to stop talking and kick it off to Tanya Mosley. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. I mean, it is a beautiful day, probably one of the most beautiful days we've had thus far, so I appreciate you taking this time. And I want to introduce to you our panelists. We first have Donald Watts. He is one of the best and most sought-after high school basketball players of his time. During that time, he was awarded multiple titles, including the 1995 Gatorade State Player of the Year, the BCI National Champions, 16U, Converse and Reebok All-American, Nike All-American, and King County Scoring Leader and Player of the Year twice. He continued his career at the University of Washington, where he was a team captain, and he led the team to four postseasons in 4 years. Before his signing, the team hadn't been there in 10 years, including two NCAA tournaments and two NIT tournaments. After college, Donald was slowed by chronic fatigue syndrome. He tried out for the Seattle Sonics and Portland Trail Blazers and played for the NBA development team, the Revelers. He also played with the Ambassadors in South America and finished his career in Belgium. Since returning to Seattle, Donald has been a commentator for Fox Sports Northwest, now Root Sports, and college basketball commentator and a KJR radio Husky Honks analyst. Give Donald a round of applause. And we also have Eric Harris, a.k. Professor E. He has been facilitating Rap 101 sessions for over 20 years. He is a member of the sociology faculty at Bellevue College, where he teaches introductory sociology, the sociology of blacks in America, race and ethnic relations, and sociology of sport, and numerous popular culture courses. He's also a member of the UW Consulting Alliance, where he facilitates workshops and provides coaching and teaching professional and organizational developmental courses. And from 2004 to 2009, he was the academic advisor in the UW Athletic Department. Give him a round of applause as well. So I love the title of tonight's discussion, You Mad Bro, Race and Sports. And I think where I'd love to start is your personal experiences. And Donald, you were saying that many people today believe that racism isn't an issue in sports because of the high number of professional black athletes. But from your perspective, you say there's a systematic way in which players are stereotyped and labeled in collegiate sports specifically.
Yeah, I think that there are roles that African Americans or that different races are expected to play. Mm. I mean, white guys too. You don't really expect to see a guy out there at cornerback that's Caucasian. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of the leadership roles are reserved for African Americans. Obviously, that's changing. But even if you look at when I was in college, an example, I was recruited, very highly, Tyler recruited, decided to go to the University of Washington, picked that school over a lot of schools. I came to the school with a lot of expectations. I remember going to my coach's office during the summer, and they asked me about a particular player who I'd known, who I played against. He was a year older than me. He was playing community college basketball. And I had heard that there was a possibility that they were going to be recruiting him, but I was surprised that they would be recruiting him because, to me, his ability to play didn't really match up to the Pac-10 level. And so I flat out asked. I was like, are we really recruiting him? I've heard that. And you know, and he's like, yeah, you know, we're recruiting him as a walk-on, or are we talking about giving him a scholarship? And I'm an 18-year-old kid. I don't know nothing about the business of college basketball. Haven't played one second, but I'm questioning my college basketball coach. Probably not the best idea, but, you know, I had a pretty good jump shot and a pretty good crossover, so I was pretty confident and sometimes pretty brash. But I asked him, I said, you know, as a walk-on or as a scholarship athlete, and the guy happened to be a white guy. And he's like, no, as a scholarship athlete, you know, we figure that, you know, he gets good grades and he could probably be a pretty good practice player for us. And at that point, I was like, well, when do we start giving scholarships to guys that might be a good practice player? I didn't get a scholarship. I didn't get an offer to any school in the country with the idea that I would come in and be a good practice player and a good citizen on campus. Everybody that recruited me with the expectation that I was going to come in and help teams win. Another thing that was introduced kind of in my era, before I went to college, if you looked at the makeup of the college student athlete, particularly the basketball player, from the Western Kentucky days with Pat Riley, where it was like all white teams, right before I went, literally, I would say 90 to 85% of the student athletes on a college basketball team were African American. And it kind of got out of hand, I guess you would say. Some of the grade regulations and different things, they were just literally plucking kids out of inner cities and putting them in college where they were prepared for education or not. And they introduced a clearinghouse, which was a system where you had to, everybody had to qualify with a GPA and a test score, and there was a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. Well, they instituted that. When you look at it, the effect that it had is it created more of a balance between the white guys who were typically playing college basketball before that and the black guys who had kind of taken over. And one of the things that they do when they institute things like that is they don't really go into the inner cities and prepare the kids that, hey, this change is coming. It's not going to work out the way it worked before, and here it is. So there's when we talk about race, it's not really – and I tell kids, I work with kids all the time. For me, it's not really fair or unfair. It's what it is. Hmm. Right, and the way that you deal with it. And so it's not always, it doesn't always work out in the lack of favor of the African-American male and in favor of somebody else, but it is a factor.
But that's interesting at the same time, because we're talking about at the collegiate level, it is a college, but yet at the same time you're talking about talent. So you're talking about raw talent, guys who may be from an inner city or maybe from lower performing schools, but have this tremendous amount of talent up against really what college is supposed to be about. Eric, I know that you have really strong feelings and you've talked really in depth about that disconnect, specifically with the NCAA and some of the challenges that some of those young men face once they arrive there.
Yeah, when I was at the University of Washington, from 04 to 09. Had the privilege of working with several great coaches, and I can say with a lot of confidence, and you can, you know, talk to other folks about this one, but Coach Lorenzo Romar, for instance, is committed to academic success and personal success unlike most coaches in the U.S. I can say that with some confidence. He is truly committed to those guys being good students, but he's also held accountable for them winning.
Performing, absolutely.
And performing. And so, you know, in sociology classes, we're often talking about what are the consequences of difference. And often you will hear all of these statistics thrown out about how affirmative action on college campuses, we shouldn't have it. We have I-200 here in the state of Washington. We shouldn't have affirmative action, except the 100 scholarships that are really set aside for underperforming people of color and are often used that way. Now, it's not always young men of color for mostly basketball and football, but I think that what race and sports to me in this day and age is really a challenge of how do we hold accountable the NCAA, high schools, and even before that, and Donald can talk more about this, but see, the problem is that we want to make this about, well, the NCAA messed up, or it's their problem. But there's a certain group of us, meaning all of us, who pay for the tickets, who will turn on the Final Four, who will make sure those bowl game tickets are taken advantage of. And until we understand that we're feeding that situation, then the new plantation, as a book that I use in sociology of sport class, which looks at the fact that you have a group of people in college that is the engine for right. the NCAA. Mm-hmm. You take away the black athlete from the NCAA, men's football and basketball in particular.
Don't do that. Don't take away.
I won't.
I'm just joking. I'm just
joking. But if you took it away, the system would collapse, literally. Now, make a quick connection here. We had that situation. Y'all saw the situation with SAE singing the song, the
yes.
chant on the bus that was
right.
caught.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the fraternity.
The
yes.
fraternity, SAE, is caught on iPhone or what have you, singing a song where they say, hang a nigga from a tree. Now, as a result of that, several Oklahoma recruits said, oh, I don't want to go there anymore. As if they didn't realize that that's what they were walking into to begin with. I mean, they didn't know.
Right.
They don't understand. Because, again, they're 18 years old.
Right.
They don't understand the business of it. They don't understand the dynamic of it. They don't understand the challenge of being a person of color on a predominantly white institution trying to survive academically with people who are essentially the equivalent of what they are as athletes. And so last point I'll make and pass it on is this. When I would work with the student athletes at the UW basketball program, for instance, and I would say, man, you guys, we need to get the study table done. They're like, oh, E, I don't want to do the study table, man. I said, look, I'm trying to get y'all prepared as best I can to be competitive in the classroom. I said, by comparison, if I took you and put the five of you on the court to play against the five best basketball players I could find that were not on the team but were up on campus, would they be able to beat you? Well, no, of course not, Eric. I was like, what if I trained for a year? Nope, couldn't beat you. They couldn't beat you? Nope. I said, what if I trained for 2 years? No, they still couldn't beat us. Why is that? Because we've been doing this our whole life, man, and we're Division I athletes. We're this, we're that. I said, and you are going into their realm when you're on campus in a system that we're doing a lot towards diversity but has not still gotten to the point where young men of color are able to compete in the same way when the pedagogical approach, the teaching style, is built around an old traditional model, which is often Anglo-centered.
I would love to, and you touching on that, I'd love for us to go back in the conversation a little bit, and then we can move back forward to this. So really, what you're talking about is something that starts very early for young black men, specifically the lure and the shine of pro sports, or being able to play sports as a way to get out of a situation, out of their life circumstance. And so with that, those are the differences that we're seeing. And if you guys can kind of talk about what you see when you're working, specifically Donald, you work with young people all of the time, and the view from a very young age of this is the way, and not necessarily the academics. College is just what you need to get through to actually get to that ultimate gold nugget of pro sports.
Yeah, I think we'll touch on some of the things that have happened recently as we go along. But I think one of the really powerful things, and I consider myself a privileged young black man because my father played for the Seattle Supersonics. I grew up on the east side. I grew up between Kirkland, Bellevue, and Mobile, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So very diverse experiences there. But I still saw myself as a kid, and maybe even me more than other people because my father was a professional athlete. I saw a lot of images of us as professional athletes. And when you see that at a young age, then that's naturally what you grow up preparing yourself to be. Now as an adult, I really feel a responsibility. I train kids in basketball. Our motto for our basketball academy is Game Changers for Life. And that's not to plug my academy, but what it is to say that I really now feel a responsibility to portray the image of a businessman for the young, not only African-American, but particularly for the young African-American males, females, for them to understand the sport not just as a physical activity, but as a mental activity and as activity that we participate in, not as a, which is what happens at an early age. You develop an all or nothing, like it's NBA or failure mentality. And I see a lot of that in the community right now. Where, I mean, when you look at the NBA, don't judge me because of my math is off because I haven't done the particular math, but you have 32 teams in the NBA. You have 12 guys on each team. Out of those 12 guys on each team, say 10 or 11 contracts are guaranteed. So you're looking at an opening of about 30 jobs a year with millions of kids shooting for it. So anytime you have ideology coming out of inner cities for young people to feel like I need one of those 30 jobs or I'm a failure, that can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our missions and one of my personal missions is to really portray myself as a family man, portray myself as a businessman, to put myself out there on social media because that's where the kids are, even though it's not something I particularly love or understand I really feel a responsibility for young people to see me in that light. And I can still, I have my 38th birthday, hence my voice right now, losing my voice. I stayed up a little bit too late on Saturday, but I can still dunk. I can still 360. I can still do a lot of things that kids wish that they can do. So I really see myself as a vehicle for them to say, hey, you think you want to play in the NBA? Like, that's all well and good. Like, I'm as good as anybody in the world 2 or 3 days a week. But you have to be more than good. You have to be lucky. There are a lot of things that have to fall into your way. And on your way to that goal, there are a lot of skills that you can accomplish that can really improve your life and better your life. And that's where I think we can talk about the NCAA. We can talk about the institutions. But I think as a community, as parents, as fathers, as uncles, as cousins, we really have to do a better job of helping the kids really value education, and not just an academic education, but the education that they're getting from the participation in sports, the education that you get from all of your social interactions, and developing that character and that integrity that I feel like the sports was about, that I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like since the Michael Jordan era, it's gotten so capitalistic, and so these guys make so much money that they become corporations. And their voice and their responsibility to the community, they're really faced with a decision. There are corporations attached to other corporations, and they're not individuals who made it and then can speak freely.
Can't speak freely.
Yeah,
at all.
With the hands up, don't shoot deal. You had a couple guys, you know, wear T-shirts, and it was quickly. They didn't suspend them games or whatever, but they took the T-shirts off pretty fast. And that's different than one of my favorite pictures that I saw that I, you know, and I'm still trying to locate it. If one of you guys want to get me a birthday present, think about it. It's the picture with Muhammad Ali when he was making his decision to not go to Vietnam with Bill Russell and Jim Brown and the Black Athlete Coalition that was around him. And, you know, I mean, he had a family to feed and things to do, and they weren't asking him to pull the trigger. They were asking him to do boxing exhibitions. Mm-hmm. But it was something that he felt strong enough about and convicted enough about and to say, hey, I have enough to go on and live. So, and it's not that the sports world needs Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali or Bill Russell. Those were guys who mastered their time. But at the same time, I feel like we do need athletes to prominently step up and really represent themselves more as professionals for the young people that are looking up to them.
Absolutely.
There's so much within that I want to get to, but I really want to, we touched very briefly on, you know, why we're focusing specifically at this moment in time on young black athletes is that really at this time, when it comes to basketball and football, they dominate those spaces at this time. Mm-hmm. I have some statistics that 75% of the players in the NBA are black. 65% are African, are black as well. Only 8.5% Major League Baseball players are black, and 29% Hispanic. And then that gets into, we can talk a little bit about why that is, but then those stereotypes surrounding other ethnicities. And so when you talk about the NHL, there's only 1% of African Americans. How many Asians within the NFL? Actually 6.9%. So talking about the different races, we've always talked about how when it comes to sports is this place where this commonality where we can all come together and we all enjoy the sport. And yet there's this elephant in the room about the perceptions and the stereotypes and who plays and why there is this dominance there. And can you guys speak to that a little bit?
I mean, I'll just briefly say, I mean, you're talking about a race issue, but at that point, you really have to look at how talent is developed. Mm-hmm. And where specific, like imagery, you know, there's not a lot of Asian people who see somebody who looks like them, who is out there bouncing a basketball. Now that you have Jeremy Lin, you can expect that maybe not right immediately that there will be more people who feel like they can make it because there was a pioneer. I mean, you could say Yao Ming, but you have to be 7'6" to see Yao Ming and think that you have a possibility. So I really think you have to look at how talent is developed to look, you know, at why the differentiators and different and what different people in different areas focus on and focus their attention on, and then also how the game is, you know, developed. One of the things basketball is the access to the game. You need a ball, a pair of shoes, and you don't even need a backboard and a hoop. You can use a garbage can. You know, I mean, my son runs around and plays on the garbage can, you know. So, and then you add that to the cool factor, the hip-hop factor, that comes out of the inner city. And then it's like, boom, we can do this. Mm-hmm. So I really think that has more to do with the alarming numbers. And then, like, the opportunity is there now, which is a beautiful thing.
You know, it was interesting. I was out yesterday. Went out and golfed with my 18-year-old son. Now, when my son started golfing, it was right around the time when Tiger Woods was dominant. And as we know, there was a lot of press towards more people of color taking up the game of golf. And, what, a week and a half ago was the Masters at Augusta National, which just, 2 years ago? Has it been 2 years yet, Zeki? I'm not sure. But, you know, they just let in their first person of color member. Mm-hmm. Was it Condoleezza Rice or was that another place? Don't quote me on that. But here's an interesting story. My son and I were out golfing yesterday, and on the front nine, we played by ourselves. And then it kind of compressed a little bit. In front of us was a foursome that included a white guy, an Asian guy, two black guys. They were dressed to part, but they were awful golfers. So they were holding us up.
They had that Tiger Woods gear
on. They had some nice gear, lime green shirt, white belt, looking good. Brother looked good, but he couldn't golf. So me and my son are standing there waiting, and eventually the twosome that came behind us, an older retired white couple. So we ended up, they said, hey, you know, why don't you play with us? We were behind these guys anyway. Interesting thing, y'all. This is a true story from just yesterday. So I'm with this older retired couple in their 70s. And we start talking and chatting as golf does. And they start talking about the Masters and Jordan Spieth winning and how him at 21 was more polished than Tiger when he won at 21. And I said, what do you mean more polished? And he says, well, he just seems to represent himself better and seems to be more eloquent at the mic and seems to be much more, I guess, just amenable to the role that he has to play in this society. And in my news feeds on Facebook and Twitter and everything else, you see Golden Boy. You see a lot of things about Jordan Spieth, like he's the next coming, as if they are saying, we got our game back. Because we were a little scared that this surge was going to happen. Now, that's just one quick notion of what has happened just yesterday. Mm-hmm. So you're on the course with me and my son, both who took up the sport, really, because we saw this interest with Tiger Woods years back. And then you have a situation in which we're told, well, his influence is waning, and this new guy's coming on, and he knows how to handle himself better.
I just have to say, too, I mean, it's so disappointing with Tiger Woods. You know, it's harder, it's easier for people to say those things and have those discussions now, post the controversy that happened with Tiger Woods. It's much harder to have those discussions when he was indeed the golden boy. When we're talking about him at 21 and how he presented himself, it's really interesting that dynamic is coming to play where people feel they can have those conversations with you. And I think that is in part because of all of the things that have happened. Those things, they still feel those that way, but they can now speak about it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that there's nothing to me wrong, though, with us having conversations in that way and a generational difference there. I thought it was a wonderful conversation because I could respond back and I said, well, I don't know. I think Tiger actually set the pace for how to handle yourself as a young person. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, if you go back to the money, the PGA Tour, trust me, they want Tiger back. They need him back. He makes them a lot of money. And that again, comes into who is going to draw to that conversation. It's not always that race and sports has to be about money. But as a sociology faculty member, I tell my students all the time, if you want to understand why we have certain policies in U.S. history, our sociological history, or anything like that, you just follow the money. Mm. If you want to understand blood quantums in American history and why one drop rule was for black folks and not for native folks, you look at where the money was going to flow. If it was one drop of native, that meant we had to pay you more out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. If it was one drop black, it meant you could go back to slavery and continue to pump out some more money for the economic engine of the U.S. in that time frame in the South. So same thing now. If you just look at the money, look at what the money would bring. I teach a class with a colleague of mine, Humaira Jackson, called Show Me the Money, the Economics of Sport. And we did a look at some of the issues around sport, including the finances, and race comes into that. Duke University just won the National Basketball Championship. In an economic study, they said that the Duke University basketball player, if paid at competitive wages on the supply and demand curve that is most often used in our capitalist system, they would be worth $1 million a year in salary. That is not their scholarship.
Right.
So you have a situation in which college athletics in general can produce a beautiful thing, which is a degree and an opportunity to see the world and some positive, great things that broaden the spectrum for young inner city kids of all races, African American in particular, right? But you also have a situation in which this same system gives one-year renewable scholarships so that if you don't perform, they can take you out. My only lobby when I was part of the athletic department at the UW was hold the NCAA accountable for a 4 or 5 year scholarship guaranteed. And if they time out to go to the NBA, they still can come back and finish. And or they can, if they don't perform, that you still committed for their education. Stop saying that it's about education when it really, and a lot of times, is not.
What's really interesting is a University of Central Florida study, recent study in 2011, found that the NCAA men's basketball tournament teams indicated that only 59% of black players graduated, a stark contrast to the 91% of white players who completed their undergraduate degrees. That speaks in line to some of the things you were talking about preparedness into college and kind of that cultural underlining thinking about what college represents for those players who come into it and really their knowledge and experience to be able to handle the college experience based on their educational experience prior.
Yeah, well, one of the big discussions now is paying college student athletes, and I kind of have a different perspective. I know that a lot of the for-profit sports pay for the non-profit sports, and I would never want see anything to happen that would affect the opportunity for any male or female to go to college on scholarship because a football player is getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side of that, when you think about paying a college student athlete, if you were to give a college student athlete, say, an extra $4,000 a year cash, what is that going to result in? A couple more pair of Jordans and some jeans? You know, like, mm-hmm. it's not going to have the effect that, you know, paying them should have. So one of the things that I really think that some of that money is investing in them, mm-hmm. Investing in financial literacy, because a lot of them are coming to the school without financial literacy, investing into them to where we really understand and see the value of the education. Because a lot of us, when we come out of inner cities or come out of any or rural or any time when you're coming out of a community where the same value isn't placed on education, you're not ready. And I feel like there should be programs. There should be, like, similar to, you know, when you get drafted to the NBA or the NFL, they have rookie programs.
Right.
You have a kid and you know he's coming from a background where he hasn't performed as great academically, or his grades look as good as somebody else's academically, but it's not from the same sort of institution that the other kids, where there is a like an enrichment type program for that student athlete, where they get to go out and meet with business leaders and do some traveling and see the world bigger than a lot of the 10 blocks that they grew up around. And then to where they really intrinsically begin to really cherish the opportunity and value the opportunity. Right now, too many of us go to play college like literally to get out of there as fast as we can. I think last year there were something like 70 or 80 early entrances into the NBA, and 30 of those kids got picked. Mm-hmm. So those are 30 kids who just threw away a college education, trying to get out of there faster than they should.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at things like that and the stat that you just said, I mean, obviously I don't have kids should be comfortable. I think one of the dilemmas for the university is, you know, if you have a star quarterback at, say, Ohio State or whatever, and he's on TV and he's, you know, making tons of money for your school, and you plucked him out of South Seattle and in an environment where he's around, you know, drugs and, mm-hmm. you know, if that's what his friends are doing and that's what mom or dad is into, or if it's just around – and he comes home for Christmas, he's coming home to see mom and dad,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so now your investment, because that's what it is, as a school, is going home to the same exact same environment. There's been nothing done for their family. There's been,
yeah.
And so not only is it like it's not a good look for the school at the end of the day.
Sure.
So to figure out a way to even extend some of those benefits of education and not, you know, opening up the doors to mom or dad on campus, but figuring out ways to
a holistic way of being able to include some of those other dynamics that are at play beyond.
And it were things that at the high level colleges did, you know, back in the day, and they got in a lot of trouble for. You know, mom and dad got a job when you went to school.
Yep.
You know, the
or alumni, a house or whatever.
Something, yeah. You know. And to me, I mean, obviously it's illegal, but it makes sense. And if it makes sense for the university and it makes sense for the kid, if we're really talking about, you know, helping people. And then also, I mean, you have to just, I mean, on the other side of that, you don't want to just pluck kids out of communities either. You want to train them to go back to those communities and be leaders. So,
talking a little bit about fiscal responsibility, there was just this this video that has made the rounds with Josh Childress from the NBA, former NBA player, who talks specifically about being broke in pro sports and after leaving the league, how within 5 years there's some crazy percentage of
80% or
of players who are broke within 5 years after retiring. And that speaks to what you're saying about educationally, just this push along without those skills of being able to understand the dynamics of money and how to balance money and use money.
Fiscal literacy, though, is an issue, and excuse me again for interrupting y'all, but that fiscal literacy is a social problem. Race is a social problem. Sports is essentially a reflection of the best of who we are and the worst of who we are. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of the issues around fiscal literacy and financial literacy are lacking amongst a lot of young people, a lot of us in general. I think that our you know, the fact that we don't understand much about money is a contributing factor, but there's also this understanding that it's easier to exploit those when you tell them, hey, this is your way to get here, to this success. This is your path to get to a better future. And if that path is sports and not a combination or a balance of sports and life balance and academic balance, then yes, you're going to end up with some issues of 70-80% of these young men after 3 to 5 years, you know, are broke.
And I you know, I listen to a lot of people talk about, oh, that's crazy, and oh, it's unbelievable that that happens, and it's really quite simple.
It really is.
I mean, you want to go to the NBA, you want to play in the NFL, you want, you know, to be a big shot at the end of the day. I mean, you want to be great at what you do, but you also want that big fancy car, and you want to elevate yourself in society. You want, you know, to have that feeling in it. And I mean, you're a rookie and you go to the NBA locker room, you've been dreaming of being a big shot your whole life, and you're playing with Shaq, and he's buying a Bentley. And you should really be driving a Chevy truck, but you're in this environment. Even though you have $1 million, you're the lowest on the totem pole in the locker room.
Right.
And you see guys buy multiple houses and multiple cars and all of that stuff. And from my social network, if there's 12 people in our locker room and I'm number 12. Then I have $1.5 million a year, but I'm in poverty still.
Right, and you're really making $400,000 a year.
And then on top of that, a lot of these kids have so many people
to care for. Behind them.
Not to care for, because adults should be caring for themselves.
But you know what I mean when I say to care for.
But
banking on them.
Banking on them, you know, rebounding for them. Pushing them, getting them to this tournament, getting them to that tournament, and, you know, whatever. And it's like, so when that first check comes, it's like, hey, we made it. Mm-hmm. We made it, man, you know. And so you get into that environment where, yeah, Shaq has his guys and whoever has their guys, and you have your guys too, but you don't, your money's not long like theirs are. I mean, I think it's pretty crazy that a guy like Allen Iverson, who, you know, at his peak was making $30 million a year, for 10 years that the second that it was over, it's broke.
Beyond broke,
yeah.
Yeah. Flat broke.
But, I mean, that's a little bit. But for a lot of these guys that play 4 and 5 year careers, it's, you know, it's music. It's anything that somebody does with the expectation that they don't determine when it ends. Somebody else determines when it ends, and you think you're going to hit forever. So you live that lifestyle, and you go from what you were making, you know, you see checks, $200,000 a month, to, and when it's over, whether it's 10 years or whatever, you'll never see that again. And then you're supposed to go get a job, making $60,000 mm-hmm. with the guy who was cheering for you, is now your boss, mm-hmm. telling you what to do when. You know, that's, it's a tough, it's not an easy thing. And I know we see it, oh my God. But, and then how could you have, emotionally and socially, and money, like where a lot of people feel like, you know, I can speak to this. I never had it myself, but I came from someone who was there. Sure. And I've seen the fall and the, you know, and that's a tough emotional deal. I think one of the only things worse than being broke is going broke.
Going
you know?
Broke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, yep. It's going back to where you were at. And so it's tough.
Let's talk a little bit about the Donald Sterling debacle that happened. I think for many people, they weren't surprised. It really spoke to this underlining idea, and I'm sure those who were in the league and a part of that world even felt it even more. But talk a little bit about the impact of us just on the outside seeing this and what this really means, and kind of talk a little bit about it.
We'll start that one.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned when I started, I grew up between here and Mobile, Alabama. And so when I heard about the situation and heard what he said, honestly, it didn't really hit me the same way. He's an 84-year-old guy who's had money for a long time. And I know that a lot of people in that area, black people, white people, like if you listen to some of this, if you put a microphone in my folks' house, my grandparents' house, when they were it's the things that they say because of the things that they've grown up in and the things that they've been a part of in private moments. I mean, so I wasn't like, oh, my God, whatever. Now, a lot of 84-year-old bigots don't date Mexican black 23-year-old women.
And own teams where 75% of the people they work for them.
And have this conversation with them, you know, mm-hmm. and own – well, I mean – It's to be debated how many of them own teams because a lot of the NFL and NBA is old money. One of my reactions was, and I think I was talking to my mother about this. Obviously I didn't agree with, I didn't like. It wasn't cool what he said, how he said, what he came back and said, how he explained. I mean, he is in his own world. Financially, mm-hmm. You know, the resources he has. Most of his friends probably, honestly, don't really take too much issue. Like, he probably has a place, a safe place to voice those kind of things. He went outside of that safe place and voiced them. But my immediate thing, and I think it's happened since then, was the firestorm that happened as it related to, you know, the social media, the Twitter, the sponsors pulling out on the team, and all of those different things, to the point where he was forced to make a billion and 0.8 profit on the sale of the team. Mm-hmm. But to the point, I mean, he was forced to sell it, but he didn't do too bad in doing so. But to the point where he was forced to sell the team. But my thing was like, I didn't like that process after either. I didn't like the social lynching of him. And I felt like it was going to open the door. And I told my mother, I said, watch what happens next. Watch what happens. And it has opened the door from the Ray Rice deal to the the running back, Adrian Peterson deal, you know, all terrible situations that before were typically dealt with legally within an organization, but you didn't have, you know, sponsors, followers, and, you know, saying, hey, if this, like, the voice of the people is so much more powerful now, but at the same time, it's so irresponsible.
Explain that. Delve a little deeper into that. That you perceive that as a negative, that there has been this light that is shining on these specific incidents.
Because they're all human beings; they all make mistakes. And now it's being judged. Like, so the Adrian Peterson situation. I didn't know what happened. I got a text from one of my boys. He was like, damn, you can't whip your kids no more? That was, and you don't, I mean, you can guess what nationality he was, mm-hmm. right? Another one of my boys was like, damn, I was like, what happened? Well, AP, you know, this going down and this. So then when I looked, and then my response was, yeah, he was a little young to get his whipped that bad. Like, that was my response. He's 4 years old. Like, that's a little much for a four-year-old. But most of my friends that were white were just like, oh, I can't believe this. And oh my, and it's like, can't believe it. I got my butt toe up the same way. Like, this, it's a cultural difference where now if Adrian Peterson was Adrian Peterson, wasn't the running back, wasn't worth whatever, like, people didn't know him, he would have spanked his kid. It would have been a wrap. If the mom reported it, would have went to CPS, they would have figured out it's just, he would have kept his job, whatever his job was.
So here's my question to both you and to Eric. In that instance, so we're talking about a light being shown on something that could have potentially been abuse, but if we as a society didn't learn about it, would anything have happened within the NFL? And I think that is the issue at play here with the Rice deal and with this deal. There were these things that were happening. Now, whether you perceive that it was right or wrong, mm-hmm. I mean, there was pressure put on the NFL because we knew about it. And so I think there was a lot of questions on whether or not anything would have happened if these young players who were making these questionable decisions would suffer consequences if we didn't know about it.
I'm not sure where this stands in the context of this discussion. But let me just add this. There's nothing good about what Ray Rice did in punching his now wife in a hotel casino in Atlantic City. There's nothing good about the situation where I think Adrian Peterson went a little overboard on the whooping his son, his four-year-olds, a little bottom there, and getting a little bit over the top. There's no good that is coming from somebody who's got some old school ideas, speaking his mind, and saying things that are negative. Obviously, in light of the world we live in, these things get blown up because they're public figures. But the fact of the matter is that I want to look at the reason why we think that we can cheer on these guys to be gladiators on Sunday and we root on them to kill each other. In the NBA, we're rooting for, why don't y'all just take him out? Give him a clothesline, take him out. We root as fans for these guys to get hurt or for our guys to kill their guys. We use those terms. Mm-hmm. And yet we don't even question Then we wonder why they don't know how to control that emotion on Monday. Mm-hmm. What you saw with Richard Sherman and his rant. I talk about this in the classroom. Y'all think about this. Richard Sherman has this rant right after he's in the heat battle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he is called a thug and tell that N-word to go home. And I can't wait till Peyton Manning shows that N-word to, you know, what it's all about and give that monkey a banana. It was some vile
stuff. It was
bad,
yeah.
Saying.
Mm-hmm.
Irresponsible.
2 days later, after the State of the Union, it was 2 or 3 days later, after the State of the Union, the Republican response was given by a congressman out of New York. This congressman didn't know the camera was off and started talking about throwing the interviewer off the effing balcony.
Yeah, I remember that.
If he got in his face again. Nobody called him a thug. Nobody called him anything in the negative derogatory. we as a society, again, I say sports is a reflection of our racial policies and our racial issues in the bigger society. And it's not right what Ray Rice did. It's not right what Andrea Peterson did. But we have systematic oppression, systematic situations of poverty. We have a system that keeps certain people in certain places in our society, and then we sell them on the idea that your way out is through sports. Come, entertain us. Come, do this for us. And then when we have them, the big black strong men on our Seahawks and on our Chicago Bears, my two favorite teams, by the way, and then they make a mistake, like Donald says, and we vilify it. I understand why, because they're in a big spotlight. And I would tell the brothers, man, y'all in a big spot. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, y'all, what are we saying when it's like we're holding them accountable, but our neighbors, the people we work with on an everyday basis, mm-hmm. are we checking on them to make sure they're not whooping their kids? Mm-hmm. Are we making sure that that's not happening? And last point, we want on Sunday and on Friday nights to have these supersized, amazingly talented, but powerful, big,
ferocious,
strong, ferocious animal black man. He's a beast. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're hearing these cops say when they're shooting brothers. They're saying, he's a beast. He looked unstoppable. Go to all the transcripts. There's
like
a consistent theme.
Yeah.
He like looked beast. Unstoppable. He could kept coming. I thought I was pulling out my stun gun, but I shot him with my regular gun.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that going to ever happen to a white person in our society? Is it going to happen where they have where Michael Brown is unstoppable from a gun? Mm-hmm. You need to pull out your gun because this brother's unstoppable. I don't think most of us are making the connection. Big, strong black men on TV, unstoppable forces. He's a beast. Michael Bennett's a beast. Big black man out on the street, not a good look. You put Marshawn Lynch on the street, and most people can't recognize the brother because he wears a helmet, and it's be dark up and down the streets here where we sit. Mm-hmm. You will have more than a few phone calls.
Absolutely. So
what is that?
And
so, I want to ask y'all to start.
Yes, and so that's what thoughts. I was just going to say is this is a discussion. So when you want to speak and you have a comment or a question, please just let me know. You can go to the mic, or I can even hear you from here. So
and that really you did a good job of touching on the point that I was trying to get to. It's not that I'm in any way in agreement with any of those things that happen, but when the guys make a mistake and then the immediate response is that they lose their right to work, it becomes difficult at that standpoint and at that time. And it's really the social pressure. And I mean, when I said the social media is irresponsible, there was a kid plays for the Minnesota Timberwolves now, the rookie Wiggins. He was being recruited by all of these schools. He picked Kansas. He had people saying, I hope you break your knee. Mm-hmm. Like that's what from people from other schools. That was their tagging him. Mm-hmm. Andrew Wiggins, I hope you break your knee. You suck. You should have came to Ohio State. You know, and I mean, I just hope that as we, go through this thing, we can start thinking about our etiquette. Social media, because it's very easy to sit behind your phone and make a judgment on somebody else's life and just splatter stuff. But then when that stuff catches fire, now all of a sudden you have these same people's employers, their sponsors, their whatever, and they're just looking at the sheer numbers of the negative publicity that something gets, and they don't, and then boom, they're out of there. And I think that is very important. It as he talked about, and I've dealt with this in college, and I think all athletes, black or white, deal with it a little bit. But anytime you reach a certain level of celebrity where people, I have people talking about me that are sitting right next to me like I'm not there. Mm-hmm. And that's a weird deal. Like you're sitting at that table and it's like, hey, that's mm-hmm. Donald Watts. Donald Watts, you know Donald Watts is? Oh, yeah, this is, and some of it is flattering, but then sometimes they go to, somewhere else with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right.
And it's like,
I can
hey, man,
hear you.
Right here.
Right.
I got they're big, they work. But yeah, I just as we talk about race and we talk about athletics, I just encourage all of us, not only for ourselves, but it's really easy to make a judgment on it. Oh yeah, you know, did you hear about so and so was sleeping with so and so's wife? And you know, I get those phone calls, some Seahawks stuff, and I was like, please don't, because those are people.
Yeah.
You know, like those are people that they're not my friends, but they very well could be my friends. And if they were my friends, I wouldn't appreciate you having this conversation. You don't know anything about what they're going through. And so That's my little piece.
But back to the Donald Sterling thing, I think why I wanted to bring this up to you guys is specifically, you know, there is this, it just brought up some of these simmering ideas. These guys make a lot of money, these sports players, it's true, but this idea that they are thought of as property, that they are thought of, you know, it has been thrown around, there have been books about it, about really these players' modern-day slavery. You know, they're brought up on the auction block, they're brought up on the block, and then they're bought and sold and traded. And so for an owner of a team to consider the players, these guys that make him lots and lots of money, not even worthy of a girlfriend taking a picture with her, whether he has dementia or whatever, that came out later. But really that idea that there are these perceptions about these guys. And talk a little bit about that. We were saying about MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry got a lot of flack for bringing this up. She had a whole show about it with the Donald Sterling controversy, and she brought up the Dallas Mavericks owner, Mark Cuban, as an example, as someone who owns these guys, who had the structure is set up, wealthy white owners who make a profit for the sale of black bodies.
See, on one level, my first thought of that is that's what it is. It is a business. It's an entertainment business. Their job, I often teach on pop culture. And one of the other things I do with Humanities Washington is to look at hip-hop music and the influence of hip-hop music. And the fact of the matter is the reason we hear certain levels and certain types of hip-hop music in the pop culture now is because that's what can be packaged and sold and commodified and made money on. So in a capitalistic system, which is our economic system, in a system in which this is what we and who we are, it's not appreciated when someone says it out loud, like, oh, hey, you are just my property and you ain't supposed to be taking no pictures with my family, or, hey, you're just my, you need to just go out and do what you need to do. Paul Hornung, back in the day, said something about, hey, we need to go get more black athletes, and the only way we can do that is we got to lower our academic standards here at Notre Dame. The way I look at it, y'all, is this, and someone maybe should speak on the mic and say if they don't agree with me on this one, but they're being who they are, in my feeling. They're being who they are. They are owners. They are disconnected, as Donald said, from the whole situation, and this is a commodity and an opportunity for them to make some money off of somebody. Should they have more social awareness? Perhaps. Should we, maybe as the folks that are the ones that fuel it, because what they do is they put a product on the floor or a product on the field that we're going to pay $50, $100, $200, $2,000 to go watch. So again, I come back to
$8,000 in the Super Bowl.
Exactly. So when you know, what you're talking about now is this situation in which I'm all for looking at the those that are in power that need to have a little bit more social responsibility and carry themselves in a higher regard. And they shouldn't treat people, humans, as they do. That being said, I still think that they're just being themselves. And if they're being themselves, then it's on us to say, they made their choice, this is how they want to do it, how are we going to respond? There was a brother from Oklahoma's football team that after the whole SAE song that was released, he got on and made a major rant. A big-time rant on the social media. And he was cursing and going off, and he says, and you all are the same dudes who'll be giving me high fives when I'm in and out of the tunnel. You're the same white boys that are always cheering me on, come to the rallies. Y'all are the same people. And my thing, y'all, is this. What are we doing to educate everyone else about the fact that that's just the way this thing works? That is the system we have. One quick story. When I was working with the University of Washington, I was working with some brothers, again, who were not motivated to do their homework. And I said, let me show you the value of a degree. We added up out-of-state tuition. We added up. How much is it going to cost you? How much does this cost? How much does that cost? How much is the university investing on you? That number was maybe $75,000 a year. Maybe. If you included plane tickets and all the food and the per diems and all that, right? Books, tuition.
It's fun, though.
Out of state.
It's fun.
Right?
Yeah.
The Nike contracts, the free stuff they get from all the Nike contracts, the free Xboxes, the things that y'all don't realize, they get a lot of free stuff under the guise of the NCAA rules. Now, let's compare that number with Pepsi Cola, a typical football game, lowest price tickets, $40, $10,000 per ticket, or just to get access to the Don James Center and the tickets to get and sit in the prime seats. $10,000 access plus the per seat ticket. You add up the contracts for all of the people that work. Think about the typical production of one single Husky football game, one UCLA football game, the bus drivers that are employed to commute people, the parking structure folks, the folks that are in the concessions. Everybody's getting paid. The NBC media folks, all of the people are making money on that deal. So how much are we talking? We're talking $33-35 million annual income for any given football program in the U.S. That's their business, y'all. That is what they do. And we as a citizenry have to say, you know what? It's just not okay for us that you're going to exploit people of color, young men of African-American descent in particular. That's where I stand. I just think we need to stop being hypocritical in our own sense and going and buying and rooting them on, but then saying, but oh, wait, Donald Sterling and this player and that player has to represent what we are basically funding.
Right. And so my feeling about that is on the athlete side of it, I think it's important for us to educate our young people to not let themselves become a product, to live a sexual life as a product, to live a social life as a product, to live a professional life as a product, but to how to keep their own, value, how to develop their own value, keep their own value, how to invest in themselves, how to invest in their community, how to make the calculated decisions, not just based on ultimate revenue, but and to understand, what's going to satisfy you and make you happy as an individual long term, your spirituality and things like that. Yeah. We can talk about the money that's made, and I thoroughly enjoyed. Loved my college experience. I had the fortune of having a very strong family around me that valued education. So I made the most of that for the most part. I mean, I'm not going to say that from day one to when I graduated that was my priority, because I feel like to a degree in most situations the student athlete is a lie. And I don't have a problem with that lie, right? I can miss class and take, as long as I'm taking care of business, but I can't miss practice. Practice is 6 o'clock in the morning. If I'm not in practice, that's not okay, right? I've had a situation where I told my coaches, hey, I was at home, but I have a B+ in that class, so instead of checking, you can just call me next time. We have to take care of your business to a minimum, but you have to, as far as your schoolwork, but you have to take your athletics to a maximum, or otherwise they're trying to get somebody else in there to do that. So in that regard, the student athlete is a lie. But me personally, I don't have a problem with the lie. My problem is educating these young people to make the most of every opportunity that's presented to you.
To navigate it.
To navigate it. And to not allow yourself to be exploited, to understand where that line of exploitation is. Now, that's getting harder and harder to do because the business of youth sports is getting younger and younger. It's getting less and less educated.
Yeah.
I mean, the MBA model, getting guys out of high school, I believe that feeds into, it's a part of the NBA's model and its model as a product. I think when you had a superstar like Michael Jordan, you had a superstar like Charles Barkley, you had a superstar like Magic Johnson, you had a superstar like Larry Bird, you had guys who were people. They didn't just totally become products. They understood their net worth and they understood their value. And at times that was a problem for the league. And it was a problem for the league that I think is a way that LeBron James will never be a problem for the league because he is 100% a product for the league.
And raised that way
since he was 12 years old. And he was being flown from Cleveland to Oakland to play for an AAU team that was sponsored.
Yep.
Right? So I think that you know, like I said, back to wrap up the point, helping people at an early age in any discipline understand where that line of exploitation is, and so that when they make that choice, it's a conscious choice rather than a subconscious choice, that they don't turn around and get slapped in the face and like, oh, man, this is, you know, what it is. I mean, people who signed up for the Clippers knew Donald Sterling was a racist before that came out.
Right.
He had a lot of things. What was my man, the Hall of Famer that worked for him? He had a bunch of suits.
Yeah. From
Elgin Baylor.
Before,
he had a bunch of suits from years past. There just was no, you know.
Sure.
There was no social media.
Yes.
I noticed that there's a certain begrudging of athletes making a lot of money. I mean, you hear that all the time. It's like, I can't believe so-and-so is making $20 million a year, whatever it is, on a contract. And it seems to me that it's because of I guess that's my question. Do you think this is just because as a society we begrudge other people making money if we're not making it? Or does it have to do with playing sports because of the perception that sports is easy and it's just playing a game and it's not real work, you know, in quotations. So I'm just wondering, which one is it? I mean, I believe, just really quickly, that when it comes to athletes getting paid, I would rather the money is in their pocket than the owner's pocket. That's always my policy. So if Russell Wilson's going to make $20 million, go right ahead. It's better in your pocket than the owner's pocket. But so I'm just wondering, why do we begrudge this? I mean, I think about this a lot. I don't have the answer. Is it just because of sports, or is it just because as a society we begrudge other people making money?
Well, I think that when you look at it and you try to make sense out of an educator or, you know, people who are in the community who have a real touchable, substantial value to the community, making $50,000 or $60,000 a year or not making enough to buy a house in the community that they teach in,
yeah,
right? And then you see an athlete making millions of dollars. You just it culturally, like, if you really think of all, well, that doesn't make sense. But athletics, as you know, culturally has played a super, super significant role. I mean, they said that Jackie Robinson was maybe more influential in the civil rights movement than Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. They're entertainers.
Well,
I mean, just in this idea of the greater
now, they're entertainers
sense.
Now, but when Muhammad Ali, like, they were much more than entertainers. They were cultural movers and leaders and thought leaders and provokers. And they were also people who broke down barriers and doors for other people. I have a friend of mine who's a business owner who I played AAU basketball with. Me and his son became really good friends. I would stay at their house. We would, you know, like, I went to his place of business one day, and like, he had a lot of people working. I went through his business, and I didn't see anybody black working for him. I didn't have to say anything. I think he saw that as a result of the relationship that we established, because I went back a couple years later and it had changed. You know, and I think that, like, us just being a part of his family change that. And I think that a lot of our sports athletes, you know, Michael Jordans and whatever, while they provide this imagery of greatness, they also have provided an acceptance for the African-American male in society over the course of time. So I think we've talked about it from the standpoint of where it is right now, But historically, sports has played a very, very significant role in breaking down a lot of big barriers, sports, music, all of that stuff, to bring people together. I think too often now, on the capitalistic side of things, mm-hmm. it lacks that oomph for us. And then when we really sit down and talk about it and we see some of our friends struggling and somebody else, you know, making $10 million a year and getting a DUI, you know, like, then you really start thinking about why are we doing this? But it's we that are doing it.
So you touched on that. You touched on something I was just about to ask you. So yes, those of the past use their celebrity status in a way that they were civil rights. They were at the height of civil rights, especially when you start talking about Muhammad Ali. Today, and you brought up Michael Jordan, who has no affiliation in any way with any type of politics or social movement, which is his choice. He is an individual, and so he can do that.
Nike politics.
Yes.
I find very specifically right, and so that has to do with the whole capitalism and this idea of them being brands and then being bought in those ways. But
I will say this about I will say this about Michael Jordan. He's taught he gave a lot of us, he taught us excellence in how to dream and accomplish and a level of commitment and excellence that was like incredible. Not just white people, I mean, not just black people,
yeah.
but white people and everything. So where he doesn't have that cultural, you know, connection to anything, the way that he did what he did so well, so elegantly and so ferociously at the same time, it really was, I think, I mean, this is why he's worth so much.
Absolutely. You know, I read the book of his childhood to my kids
yeah.
at night. I mean, it's an amazing story. It's a wonderful story. But to Zaki's question, though, I mean, I find that specifically there seems to be this begrudging, this idea of, when it comes specifically to the NBA and basketball over the last decade or two, where people feel this sense of resentment for the fact that these guys make a lot of money. I personally don't feel that great sense from some of the other sports as much as I do from the NBA. Do you feel to that? Can you guys talk to that? And if so, does it have to do with the racial component in any way, the underlining component? Am I making sense in that question?
I
think lately, one of the reasons, I can't speak for everybody's begrudging in it, you know, but at the same time, I think for a while the NBA displayed a lack of professionalism that you would expect for somebody who played in the NBA. And I actually was having a conversation with Charles Barkley a couple years back, and Charles Barkley reaches out to all the guys that played before him when he comes to town. He likes to hang out with the guys who kind of paved the way for him. And one of the things that he talked to me, and this could kind of go into maybe some of the explanation. Well, you know, Charles is like, we always dressed up. We always put on a suit and a tie, and we did that because the guys before us did that. Charles was called in to Philadelphia to talk to Allen Iverson, to mentor Allen Iverson, and the conversation that he shared with me that he had with Allen was that, man, it's cool. You know, you got the cornrows, you got tattoos on your neck, you know, wear your hat backwards, you wear your do-rag. Like, that's cool for you. You're making $30 million a year. But what about all the little kids that are looking up to you that'll never have a professional contract, that need to go get a job, that can't walk in with cornrows and tattoos on their neck and work in a professional setting? And I think that maybe that has something to do mm-hmm. lately with some of the begrudgingness. And I feel like I feel like it's changing. I feel like the NBA is getting a lot more professional. But there was a time when the NBA was literally in Allen Iverson's image. Mm-hmm. All the young guys that were coming in, the way they approached it, the way they dressed, the way they walked, the way they talked. They're on the radio, the guy who played for Dallas talking about 80% of the league smokes weed. And
right.
You know, it's like nobody wants to hear that kind of stuff from somebody who's getting paid $12 million to do a job.
I would love to... Eric, you brought up Marshawn Lynch, and you just brought him up in the context of of how he looks and then if he were just a regular, if he's walking out in the street. But let's talk a little bit about the racial factors within the Seahawks, but specifically with Marshawn and his form of protest and not speaking with the media, but then how it may be deeper. I read an article about how as a young man in college, he knew very much so that he was perceived as the black college player on scholarship here. And so with that, he made a conscious choice to say, I am going to shut everyone out and just focus on myself. And of course, when he refers to any black media person, he says Africa to them, you know, like, hey, Africa, right away, in the middle of press conferences. Kind of, delve deeper into him. Exactly, yes.
Well, I mean, I can't speak, obviously, I don't know Marshawn personally. There are some folks that I have had the honor of working with that I can speak to more direct, but I think that I perceive what Marshawn is doing and Richard Sherman, honestly, is brilliant. They're just doing what is called marketing. They're getting attention brought to themselves. And these brothers are from Stanford University, I think, is Richard Sherman.
Yes.
And Berkeley.
Yep.
He reps Oakland more than Berkeley.
Yeah, I know. He said
but
he
his where he went to college, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, he does rep Oakland.
These are brothers who were and have run in circles with scholars across, you know, at their schools. So my thought on this one is simply that they are, you know, Marshawn, to me, when I looked at him saying, I'm here because I'm, you know, I don't want to get a fine. He was standing up for, you know, it was a classic case of protest, social movement. To me, when in sociology we talk about issues of social change, we are talking about the idea of speaking your mind, or maybe in this situation, not speaking his mind. Because again, he says, what do I have to do? You're paying me to entertain, run the football, score touchdowns if we hand him the ball. Oh, sorry, I snuck that in there. And if if that's what he's paid for, he says, you know, doing this other stuff, the professional aspects of it, as Donald said, is part of his job as well. So they said, hey, you got to go. He said, I'll go. But this is his way of protesting it. And y'all, while I appreciate the notion around the money and the aspect of it, I think I want to also remind us that what we say, again, as a society, we value. Donald, you said something that made me think about this. You said we value, as a society, we say we value our children. Right? We say that. Mm-hmm. 20 children are shot up in Connecticut. Have we had any change on that front? No. We say we value our children, yet who are the lowest paid folks probably in our society? It's those that are working with the most vulnerable in our society, the preschool kids. I'm sick of us saying that we value one thing, but putting our money towards the entertainment aspects, the sports aspects, the pop culture stuff. I would rather we just own it and say that's who we are. Obviously, we value our sports athletes more than we value our teachers and our educators and our public servants. That's just the fact. And to me, it's like as soon as we can acknowledge that's the fact, then perhaps we will rebalance the scale. But until we acknowledge that that's the fact, we're going to have this situation in which we're going to look at it and go, I wonder if they're begrudging these folks and these brothers because they're black. I wonder if it's because they're professional athletes who are black. I wonder if it's because of any of these other things. It might be. It could be. But a lot of it, to me, speaks to what is it that we really, truly, you said culture. What does the culture say we value? We can't keep saying we value our children and pay people that aren't so, that are taking care of our kids. We can't. We have to stop saying that we value education when we are having a situation in which if you want to go to the NBA, the NBA has control over that situation and says you have to go to college for 1 year. But do you know what they do in that 1 year at a semester school?
Nothing.
They do nothing. They go for one semester. They barely pass. Then they go to the second semester and don't attend because they don't have to. The NCAA has a rule that says if you start the tournament eligible, you can finish the tournament eligible. There's system.
That rule is.
It's a terrible rule, but that is the fact.
And
the fact is that as a member of the academic staff, I did not know that until I was facing the possibility of a couple of my guys not being eligible. Mm-hmm. The brothers knew it. I didn't know it. Mm-hmm. So what does that say? That the compliance staff and the folks that were in charge of that department didn't think that I needed to know, because maybe I would be pressing on them a little bit, or what? They thought I was going to let them get by? The thing is that, y'all, again, I saw very clearly where, like I said, I'm going to speak again positively about Lorenzo Romar. 100% graduation rate the years I was there. 100% graduation rate. If they did not go to the league, they graduated. Because he put upon me every single meeting, every single day, you have to make sure these guys go to class. You have to help them learn how to be successful young men. You have to bring in speakers and anybody you might know that can help them get to the next level. Because I know that they want to go to the league, Eric, but they may not make it. And I want them to have a life. He has huge amounts of – I have lots of love and respect, obviously, for him, because he walked his talk. He has integrity with me on that deal. I saw other situations in other sports and other institutions that I visited as a staff member that I can't say that about. So there we are. I'll leave it there and give you the last word on this.
And, do we have any more questions from out there?
Or like comments.
Comments, questions.
We'd also love to hear that as well. Donald, you talked a little bit about, well, you talked a lot tonight about what the answers are at the younger level with the younger kids, and really teaching them the value of character and integrity and what they could gain from the game beyond this idea of one of those 30 jobs that's available once they get to that level. But speak to us as a society. I mean, the players that are currently there, what role do they play in providing really context to what they do, and also being an image, a role model that is beyond this kind of hip-hop model, and then what we as a society can do to really drive home that idea?
Oh, I think the each individual player, you can't mandate it. I feel like you have to educate people and really help them understand how important, first, the opportunities that they have in front of them are for their own life, and then second, how influential they are in the lives of others. And when I say in the lives of others, when you're a college student athlete, it's hard for you to realize you're getting your schoolwork, you're in the weight room, you're hitting the track, you're doing all those things. But it's hard for you to realize how much impact you have, not only on young people, but on adults and influence, you know, the power to change minds and connect with folks and stuff like that. And for me, I really hope that, all athletes, entertainers, educators, teachers, everybody really understands the significance of the things that they say and they do, and then they do what's appropriate for what their outcome is, and that all of our outcome is more than just financial. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we live in a capitalistic society, but I think it's a society where, like the example that we use with Michael Jordan, the difference with Michael Jordan, he didn't, that wasn't his mission to create all of that. Mm-hmm. And it's this, I mean, you can go back in history to Christ. Like, his mission was not Christianity. It was to speak the word of God, right? And then the Nike follows, right? The followers come, and then they form it and make it institutionalized and all of those things. And so for each of us as individuals, and I think that's where our joy, and then on the other side of that, as consumers, to make a conscious effort on what we consume. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, not just to, this is something that I stress to the players that I work with, right? You can't look at LeBron and Durant and Russell Westbrook and what as your models for basketball, because at the point that they get a guaranteed contract for $120 million, they're no longer a basketball player. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're a guy that if they don't like what their coach says, they fire the coach. So that's not a good model for you as a student athlete striving to be better. You know, even if they try to be a good model. You tell LeBron James to post up in Cleveland, he's fired a coach. I don't want to post up. Hmm. right? And that's not something that kids are privy to. But the way that LeBron plays the game is not the way that a kid should try to play the game if he wants to make the most out of his life playing the game. Now, at the point that he gets a guaranteed contract, then you can look at LeBron for your model of how to act. But if you want to go play for a college basketball coach, and I ask you, all these kids want to play college basketball, who are the top five players in the position that you expect to play in the country, in college? Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is, I'm talking about elite level players.
Right.
I've asked this question to hundreds of kids. I've had one. And the one is not one that's going to play at the next level. Right? And so the kids aren't taking it seriously. And then I tell them, when I grew up, I could tell you who my guys were. Allen Houston, Jimmy Jackson, Michael Finley, Kendall Gill, and I'm missing one. Well, all of those dudes, if you Google them, they all have a similar body type. They look familiar to me. And so my quest to be a student athlete, I'd watch those guys every time the game was on. Mm-hmm. And when I got on the road for a showcase, they have more showcases, more opportunity now than ever for kids. But I had acquired the skills that he had coached successfully. So when they saw me play, they offered me a scholarship. Mm-hmm. And then when they came to my home, some of the proudest moments of my recruiting, and I felt accomplished as a young man, and I didn't go to any of their schools because I wanted to take the skill sets that they made their school successful with and apply it to my home school, the University of Washington. But when they came into my home and they said, "You remind me of Michael Finley, and we want you here." Like, we were very successful with Michael Finley at Wisconsin. We want you here. And Ohio State came to my room, they said, to my house, and said, "Hey, you remind me of Jimmy Jackson." So I had a realistic outlook on what it was. I wanted to play in the NBA. I wanted to be I didn't even want to play in the NBA. People used to ask me all the time, "How do you deal with the pressure of being the son of a former Sonic? How do you deal with, you know, my dad played for the Sonics? How do you deal with that?" I didn't know that pressure because my goals were to do so much more than what he accomplished in his 7-year career. I wanted to be in the Hall of Fame. I wanted to be a 15-time All-Star. And I worked like that. I got chronic fatigue syndrome by approach the game in a step-by-step basis so that the game, at the end of the day, when I couldn't play it anymore, it saved my life. When I was in depression, when I was struggling, the things that I learned from the game, the experiences I had at the University of Washington literally are the reason I'm still here talking to you when like I was in a dark, dark place. And that's what I want for kids coming up. I want them to appreciate not just, means to an end, but a beautiful, beautiful journey where you get to meet a lot of people and opens yourself up to a lot of opportunities and to capitalize on those opportunities.
That is what sports is, and I think that kind of sums it up. So I don't want to add anything else other than to say, I think, y'all, that's what the beauty of sports should be, can be, and the addition of race in sports is really just saying we would like to see young men of all backgrounds have the equal opportunity for access to education, opportunity for a better life, a more balanced life, and some of that can be done through sports, but a lot of it is us as a society really taking a hard look at what we consume, where we consume, and where we're putting our energies and our values.
Thank you, Donald and Eric. You all were great, and thank you for sharing your story, Donald, specifically.
Thank you, guys.
If you have any questions or anything of these guys, please come up and chat with them, and thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Humanities Washington presented this Think and Drink event on April 20th, 2015 at the Royal Room in Columbia City. Journalist Tanya Mosley moderated the discussion with Bellevue College sociology professor Eric Davis and former University of Washington basketball star Donald Watts. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Stay tuned for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.